It's Wednesday, November 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Doug Bernard, live in Washington. Coming up, New York police say the suspect in Tuesday's attack in Manhattan acted in the name of ISIS. Australia's famed Ayers Rock will soon be closed to climbers. And a new documentary shows the roots of the deep political divisions in the United States.
I think it's really important to try and regularly confront the fact that of how big this country is, and to allow that vastness to inform the decisions that we make.
That's all coming up ahead this half hour. Authorities in New York are questioning the driver of a rented pickup truck who mowed down people on a busy bike path on Tuesday, attempting to learn his motive for the deadly terror incident. At least 8 people were killed and 11 others injured in the attack. Officials linked the suspect, 29-year-old Saifullah Saipov, an Uzbek immigrant who came to the United States in 2010, to social media accounts that contain IS-related material. News reports said that a note was found at the scene of the attack in which he claimed allegiance to the jihadist group. Saipov was shot in the abdomen by a New York policeman in the lower Manhattan area of the city, but survived. Authorities questioning him before he went under surgery Tuesday evening. New York Deputy Police Commissioner John Miller Wednesday described the initial findings.
Based on the investigation overnight, it appears that Mr. Saipov had been planning this for a number of weeks. He did this in the name of ISIS, and along with the other items recovered at the scene was some notes that further indicate that.
President Donald Trump says he will work with Congress now to immediately end the diversity lottery program, which allowed Saipov to immigrate to the United States.
I am today starting the process of terminating the diversity lottery program. I'm going to ask Congress to immediately initiate work to get rid of this program, diversity and diversity lottery. Diversity lottery sounds nice. It's not nice. It's not good. It's not good. It hasn't been good. We've been against it.
Karen Greenberg is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law in New York City. She told VOA's Sarah Williams about the significance of the attack.
This is the first lethal terrorist attack with a vehicle in the United States. There was an attempt last year with a vehicle at a college campus in the United States, but it didn't result in any deaths. So this is the first lethal attack of this kind. So it is a threshold moment for us.
Is it known about the timing, the fact that this was coming up to an official holiday, you know, Halloween, and there was going to be a nearby Halloween parade?
It could have been that. You never know. It was closer to the World Trade Center than it was the original World Trade Center than it was to the Halloween parade. So you never know. It's hard to imagine that they were completely separable, the parade and this. I thought it was rather amazing that the public officials in New York, the mayor of New York, the governor of New York, the police commissioner, all agreed that they should continue with this parade no matter what, which was, I thought, a rather brave message. And it sent a very good signal to New Yorkers that they're safe. So it may have been timed that way, and it turned out to have worked in a way that I think strengthened the reassurances rather than minimized them.
Is it known any possible connection between the suspect and ISIS?
There were notes found. There are different reports. Some say there was a note found in the truck, the rented truck that was used to mow down these bicyclists. Others say that were notes found outside the truck, and that these notes or note said that this was attack was being done in the name of ISIS. What that means, usually in this country, it means some form of self-radicalization where an individual decides to identify his violent attack with saying that he's aligned with ISIS, but it's usually a very loose association. So that's all that's known at this point.
Since ISIS has lost militarily some of its geographical points in the Middle East recently, I know that there have been concerns from a number of observers that perhaps there might be more attacks in whether either North America or in Europe. Does this mean that the United States and Canada and Europe need to be especially vigilant in the coming days and months?
I think that the vigilance has kind of been at the same level in terms of ISIS since the first ISIS indictment in this country, which was March of 2014. There are varying interpretations of what the disappearance of the caliphate and of ISIS actually having territory will mean. And one is, yes, that it'll have more localized attacks. But, you know, Americans, the Americans and the people living in the United States who wanted to go and fight ISIS has been a dwindling percentage of the ISIS cases for the last couple of years. It has been individuals who have focused more of their attention here recently. So that's the first thing. The second thing is one of the big concerns about having a caliphate and individuals going there is that they get trained. And so as much as it might spread a message of violence and hatred that may, you know, get people to affiliate with it and commit violence, one of the real concerns of law enforcement and national security officials, and this is true globally, is to keep these individuals from getting trained. Now, it's true, it doesn't take much to go rent a truck and get some what looked like they were fake guns. But the fact is that if you can decrease the amount of organized, trained violence, you're helping counterterrorism efforts immensely. And so I'm not sure how the loss of the caliphate will play out. I think over the long haul, it will weaken ISIS and its message significantly.
Karen Greenberg is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law. She spoke with International Edition's Sarah Williams. Well, VOA social media editor Andrew Palcheski joins us now. Andrew, yesterday, social media was abuzz about the heads of the social media giants like Facebook and Twitter who were testifying on Capitol Hill. It looks like they were back today.
They were indeed back on Capitol Hill for a second day of questioning in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. You had the top lawyers for Facebook, Twitter, and Google all talking about the Russian interference on their social networks. Now, whenever you put something in a committee room in Washington, you're going to have Republicans, you're going to have Democrats. Inevitably, there's going to be political angles. And this was no different for this. Democrats focusing on the impact on Hillary Clinton's campaign, of course, because that was their candidate. And many of these ads supported, they said, Donald Trump, or at least influenced people to try to support him. But Republican senators arguing that ads were seen by too few people to have an influence on the election, and saying that where the ads were targeted were not necessarily swing states. There's also the question of if you see a Facebook ad, is that really going to impact who you're voting for?
Well, I mean, the U.S. intelligence community made up of a number of organizations have all come out and basically said, look, these Russian-sponsored ads, whether they came from the government of Russia or, you know, independent actors working under their auspices, did influence the election. Was there agreement at least on that in the hearing?
There was. That was the one point of universal agreement, that this is a major issue, that it did have influence, if not impact, on the 2016 presidential election. And it's still continuing. Many of these senators noting that these ads are being constantly purchased by these groups, by Russian influence groups, the Russian Information Agency. It didn't just stop with the presidential election. It goes on to this day. And so that actually was something that captured a lot of attention on the other side of Capitol Hill, because while this testimony was going on in the Senate side, the House Intelligence Committee released 24 of these ads that were produced across Facebook, Twitter, Google. They said that these are the first batch of ads they're releasing. This is the first time anyone has seen any of these ads that have been referenced. Mm-hmm. And they call it a representative sample of the different ads that were purchased across these platforms to influence opinion on different issues.
So what did these ads look like?
Well, some of them were focused on different issues like race or guns or LGBT issues. So, for instance, there was a page that was promoted called Black Matters, which appeared like a Black Lives Matter page, of course, advocating for rights for African Americans. There was a page that had a Trump is not my president event in New York, so trying to rile people up and create divisions. One page had a Hillary Clinton for American Muslims photo on it that was being promoted. And then an Instagram video that allegedly showed a man teaching a child how to use a gun, and that was actually targeted towards gun rights advocates, the hope being that they would share that, it would create divisions and conflict between gun right advocates and gun opponents.
What I'm hearing from you is maybe less of a sort of single-minded campaign to target one candidate and elevate another, but just a broad campaign to stir the pot, to create dissension, to create discord.
Exactly. And that's where you have this back and forth about the influence on the election. Because while there were ads that did talk about the specific candidates, there were many that also talked about issues that were not directly related to the campaign, but could influence people's support. Now, my favorite of these ads, because they are so bizarre and because they show just the scope and just strangeness of this all, there was one ad that the House Intelligence Committee released that depicted Satan and Jesus arm wrestling in an illustration. Satan is saying, "If I win, Clinton wins," and Jesus responds, "Not if I can help it." Again, that is focused on a specific candidate, so that's an example of one of those instances. The other bizarre one is Buff Bernie Sanders. This is a coloring book with illustrations depicting the Senator Bernie Sanders, who is running in the primaries against Hillary Clinton, as a muscle-bound bodybuilder in an effort to divide the Democratic Party during the primaries so that Bernie Sanders fans would share that. So those are two examples where candidates were involved in the ads. But in addition to those, we do see a host of other issues, like you said, meant to stir the pot, to try to divide Americans, and to create this discord among the American electorate.
This is a confusing new world.
It is, and now we have Buff Bernie Sanders added into it. So if it wasn't confusing before, it's confusing and even stranger now.
Thanks for that. Andrew Palcheski, thank you so much.
Thanks, Doug.
Social media editor Andrew Palcheski. Here are some of the top stories that we're following at this hour. Britain's defense minister resigns over allegations of sexual misconduct. Hamas gives up control of the Gaza Strip border crossings. Donald Trump heads to South Korea amid nuclear tensions with the North. The U.S. votes against a U.N. measure to lift economic sanctions against Cuba. Much more on these stories and many others at our website at voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
When volcanoes erupt, they blast huge amounts of gas and dust particles into the atmosphere. Scientists say the dust and gas reflect sunlight away from the Earth, causing a cooling effect. A new study by researchers at Columbia University suggests volcanic eruptions can also worsen the melting of our planet's ice sheets. Researchers say they found evidence volcanic eruptions quickly caused severe melting of the ice sheet that blanketed a good part of northern Europe toward the end of the last ice age between 12 and 13,000 years ago. The study notes that in some cases, the erupting volcanoes were located 1,000 or more miles away. The surface of the ice sheet was darkened by the falling volcanic ash, which allowed it to absorb more solar heat than usual. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition, coming to you live from Washington. I'm Doug Bernard. Coming up, political battle lines being drawn in the United States. First, reports citing senior Trump administration officials have said that President Donald Trump is likely to name Jerome J. Powell, a current member of the Federal Reserve Board, to replace Janet Yellen as chairman, with an announcement planned this Thursday. However, these officials caution the decision is not yet final, and Ms. Yellen may yet be handed another term, or it may go to a third possibility, Stanford University economist John Taylor. The choice will be crucial to the U.S. and global economies. Gary Huffbauer, an economist with the Washington-based Peterson Institute, told VOA's Victor Beatty that while Yellen has generally pursued monetary policies that Mr. Trump has advocated, the decision may come down to the president's decision to nominate his own person to head the central bank.
That's probably the dominant reason. There's a second reason, though, and that's that Trump feels that the Fed has been overly strict in regulating banks. And Yellen is part of that overly strict group, you could say, in the Fed, which Trump is trying to replace. And there, on that issue, one of the candidates, namely Jerome Powell, is a little less aggressive on regulating the banks, more willing to relax some of the regulation. So that's the reason why his name, that is Jerome Powell, seems to be the number one, because he very much the same monetary policy that Yellen has been advocating, but more relaxed on the bank regulation. So that, I think, appeals to President Trump, that combination.
But between the two, they're basically the policy on gradual interest rate hikes will probably continue.
Yes, it would. And there, the third candidate that you mentioned, Professor John Taylor, whom I know, is thought to be a little more hawkish. I don't think a lot more hawkish, but he is more hawkish than either Yellen or Powell. And what does that really mean? Well, here's the issue. Interest rates have been below the rate of inflation. We don't have much inflation, but interest rates are still lower. When inflation gets up to 2%, will the Fed at that point raise interest rates to be a little bit above inflation? That probably is where Taylor would be. But Yellen or Powell probably would have a pause on that and say, well, we need to have a bit of catch up on the inflation. So it's okay if it goes to 2.5%. We don't need to push the interest rates up to 3%. So that's the real difference between Yellen and Powell on the one hand and Taylor on the other.
Gary Huffbauer of the Peterson Institute. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Australia's world-famous Uluru, formerly known as Ayers Rock, will now be closed to climbers beginning in 2019. As VOA's Steve Miller explains, the decision ends a decades-long campaign by Aborigines to protect their sacred monolith in the Northern Territory.
Scrambling up Uluru, the symbol of the outback, also known as Ayers Rock, is seen by many tourists as a must-do on their visit to Australia. However, climbing the world's largest monolith was banned on Wednesday, November 1st, amid concerns it was becoming a theme park, undermining the giant red rock's deep cultural significance. Those that make the climb do so against the wishes of the traditional Aboriginal owners, the Anangu, to whom the site is sacred. The unanimous decision to ban hiking up the iconic monolith was made at a meeting of the Uluru Kata Chuta National Park Board, made up of traditional owners and national park representatives. The director of the national park, Sally Barnes, says the decision to end hiking was made to try and heal some of the wounds on Uluru.
We're going to have to look at, to talk to the board, to work with the traditional owners and see what they want to do. We'll need some experts to help us work out how we restore and rehabilitate, if that's what the traditional owners want.
Figures from Parks Australia indicated that only 16% of visitors climbed the rock between 2011 and 2015, down from 74% in the 1990s. Around 300,000 people visit yearly, with Australians and then the Japanese most likely to climb. Sammy Wilson is one of the landowners and called Uluru an extremely important place and not a playground. He also said that the notion of climbing the 348-meter sandstone monolith would someday come to an end was not new.
I've talked at length and interacted with visitors, and the consistent questions I've been asked is, actually, when are you thinking of removing the climb from this place? I work with lots of visitors on a daily basis. I do it all the time. And if anything, they ask us when we will close the climb.
The Anangu have always refused to climb Uluru and considered it sacred. The site is often closed to climbers after the death of important indigenous figures as a mark of respect. The park board in 2010 had indicated it would close the formation to climbing if the activity was declining and if other park experiences were attracting visitors. The last day of climbing will be October 26, 2019, chosen because it is the anniversary of the date in 1985 when the land and the formation, once called Ayers Rock, were handed back to the traditional owners. Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA's International Edition coming to you live from Washington. I'm Doug Bernard. So here's a question. Just what exactly do Americans really think about last year's presidential election? In the new documentary 11-8-16, executive producer Jeff Deutschman showcases 16 Americans from all walks of life throughout that day. The result is an eye-opening documentary about the political and cultural divides that still polarize America today. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with Deutschman about his work.
Did you vote today?
From the liberal college student to the conservative West Virginia coal miner,
the election, the future for the coal industry.
Jeff Deutschman's documentary, 11-8-16, follows American voters during Election Day last November. He showcases 16 out of the 50 voters his team of filmmakers had followed that day across the United States.
We wanted it to be a broad cross-section of individuals that represented, you know, diversity geographically, demographically, and ideologically.
From a Sikh cabbie supporting Democrat Hillary Clinton in Queens, New York,
live long and prosper,
to an exonerated convict in Alabama who gets back his right to vote for the first time in 30 years, to a pro-Donald Trump military veteran in Miami, and a dreamer whose future is at stake if Trump won, 11-8-16 shows that people voted on issues they felt affected them personally. The film also shows that most believed media projections that Hillary Clinton was going to win.
The election will be over by 9 o'clock. They'll call it by 9:30, and everything will be peaceful and wonderful.
What if it goes the other way?
What? Not going to go the other way. No way. Mark it down.
Jeff Deutschman says his documentary reveals deep cultural divisions in American society the media missed.
So I think it's important not to get stuck in the echo chambers that we all live in. You know, we surround ourselves with people virtually and in real life that are like-minded. And I understand that. I do it as much as anyone. But I think it's really important to try and regularly confront the fact that of how big this country is, and to allow that vastness to inform the decisions that we make about how we vote and, you know, how we speak.
The film does not take sides. We get invested in these 16 characters who, despite their political leanings, make compelling arguments based on their circumstances, as in the case of Tom, a small businessman from Massachusetts.
If the economy got better and I was bringing more people and more work into my shop and I could delegate a little bit more, then I'd be able to spend more time with my family. That'd be huge. That would be huge for me.
The film also shows how campaign messages and partisan media feed into people's prejudices and fears.
When Hillary gets elected, and I think she's going to get elected because she's going to
Cheat?
She's going to cheat. She's going to raise the taxes on everybody, and healthcare right now is crushing us anyway. So I'm concerned that we're going to have a tough time making ends meet.
Take that stupid hat off, man.
I will not take this hat off.
On the other side of the spectrum, the documentary also shows the concerns of minorities if Donald Trump won. Deutschman says a year later, America remains deeply polarized across the same lines. He hopes that films like his, by humanizing the American electorate, can encourage dialogue. Penelope Poulou, VOA News.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
And that is our program for today. Thank you so much for being with us. Remember, you can check out all the latest news at our website, voanews.com. And we hope you'll join us again tomorrow for another installment of International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. and its international allies and partners are taking new steps to ensure that President Donald Trump's vision for a world that is secure against terrorist threats is realized, said U.S. Coordinator for Counterterrorism Nathan Sales in a recent interview. One of those steps is the recent endorsement with partners of the Global Counterterrorism Forum of the Anatolia Memorandum on the Protection of Soft Targets.
The Anatolia Memo contains a number of practices for governments and private sector entities to use together in cooperation to protect places to which the public is invited. Stadiums, restaurants, parks, sidewalks, against terrorist threats. This is an increasing trend that we're seeing overseas. We're seeing it here at home, and so it's important for us all to work together to secure our public spaces against terrorist attacks.
The United States, in partnership with Morocco, also recently announced the launch of a new initiative to address the growing threat posed by homegrown terrorists. We've seen in the past 3 years a number of foreign terrorist fighters who have traveled to Iraq and Syria to fight with ISIS, some of whom have come home and perpetrated deadly terrorist attacks, said Ambassador Sales. But that's not the only threat we face.
We also have to be mindful of people who are inspired by ISIS or inspired by Al-Qaeda. They may not have a membership card, they may not have any battlefield experience, but it doesn't take much more than simply renting a truck and driving it into a crowd. So the threat of homegrown terrorism, people without any operational ties, is a very serious problem. It's a threat that's on the rise, and it's one that we're going to be focusing on.
The United States and Global Counterterrorism Forum partners are also focusing on strengthening criminal justice and other rule of law institutions that confront terrorism.
Counterterrorism is not just for soldiers. It's not just for spies. It's also for cops. And so part of what we've done here in the United States is create capabilities for state law enforcement officers and federal law enforcement officers alike to partner together to bring criminal charges in cases where that's warranted.
We're doing the same sort of thing, said Ambassador Sales, standing up these capabilities with partners around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.